Welcome. My name is Robert.
And I'm Lindsay.
And you're listening to The Weightless Space. Today is episode 4. The title is The Apostles of Unbelief. Requires a little bit of a background story. Now, I know that you are not hip on the YouTube.
Me?
You.
Yeah, it's not my... I mean, I listen to music sometimes on YouTube, but I don't watch a lot.
You don't watch any shows, none of that stuff.
Not really.
No. There are two famous people. All the kids, by the way, they're all the YouTube stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's a...
I think you just called me uncool.
You're cool in your own right. You're okay. Just not into the YouTube stuff. So, there are two YouTubers named Rhett and Link. And for most people that are somewhat aware of YouTube will know those names.
Okay.
Of a certain demographic, however, they're extremely popular. So, why?
Yeah, why are they popular?
They're just charismatic, fun, good-looking guys that are popular. Mm-hmm. They have a family-friendly-ish show called Good Mythical Morning, a couple ear biscuits, and all kinds of little shows that they've put out over the years where they do silly stuff. And anyway, they're very popular. You don't really need to know a lot about Rhett and Link's story. I'm going to give a little bit of a background on it. Okay. For today's discussion.
Okay. Story time.
But I do want to just showcase, they have a meteoric rise to popularity. They're very, very popular now. So much so that they go on Jimmy Fallon and they do little bits and they eat weird foods. And, you know, it's kind of like physical comedy, slapstick, goofy stuff. Now, the kicker is if you have a teenage child, there's a good chance that they very much know who they are. Now, okay. Also...
It's the I Love Lucy of this generation?
Sure. Yes. They have a history of being in Campus Crusade for Christ, back then, now called CRU, missionaries, college missionaries, and very active in their faith and churches at the time, years ago.
Okay.
And so... A lot of Christian parents loved these guys because they were wholesome and they kind of had some values. Their show wasn't ever really about faith-based topics or whatnot, but they exemplified, hey, you can be cool and funny and all this stuff and also be Christian and such. So
safe for the little years, to quote a friend.
Safe for the little years, exactly. It's been years, but they've recently deconverted from Christianity. Mm-hmm. They've had a couple of questions about it and have released, I want to say, 3 episodes. It's been like 3 years, and they do like an annual update on their spiritual journey. At the time, it was a very big deal. You know, there was a lot of articles written about it. And in fact, today's episode is we're going to look at an article that discusses their deconversion and deconstruction. And I want to analyze the response. I kind of want to deconstruct the deconstruction of their deconstruction, and you'll see what I'm
saying. That's very meta.
It's so meta.
We're in the Matrix today.
Yeah, we're in the Matrix. It's Inception.
Okay, well, let's go.
Well, wait. Okay. And so...
This is my life.
I will point, you know, in the show notes, links to the different episodes where they talk about their faith, and it's okay. Very compelling. Uh-huh. And one fellow, I don't know their names very well, but one fellow is still kind of spiritual-ish, though not Christian. Mm-hmm. And the other guy, honestly, when you hear his story, he seems like he was really hurt and kind of wants nothing to do with it.
Okay.
Both of them speak very kindly, no words of hatefulness or anything like that. So they come across as gentle and they have respect and they know that they're talking about something weighty. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So there's a website called the Gospel Coalition. And they publish materials for evangelical Christians to read and think about. And I used to be a really great enjoyer of a lot of their artifacts. They teach, I think they have a lot of curriculum-based stuff and a lot of things you can read about for evangelicals. Okay. And there's an article called Let's Deconstruct a Deconversion Story, The Case of Rhett and Link.
Okay.
And it's written by Elisa Childers. I hope I'm saying that name right. And in this article, she gives some background on not only herself and, you know, she's falling in love with Ricky Schroeder, which I don't know if you know, that may be just older than your, because that was from Silver Spoons. Remember that old TV show, Silver
nope.
Spoons? Okay. It was a blonde hair.
I wasn't born yet. Husband.
Right. You probably might
That's
not have been, actually.
Joke. I don't think I was.
She talks about, you know, she had an infatuation as a teenager, and so she understands this. And then she goes into why kids these days have found Rhett and Link to be engaging, and, you know, they're infatuated with them. Again, they're very charismatic, good-looking guys. So makes, you know, she's making the connection that makes sense that people would gather around them, okay? But then she starts to kind of give their theological backgrounds. Not theological. They're just their spiritual backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And talks a little bit about it. And all of this, again, is public. She begins to then deconstruct this. And she starts making some thoughts and assertions that I kind of want to stop, read, and consider, and get your opinion on it
okay.
from someone that's criticizing someone that has left the faith. Again, that's, I think, the framework. Long-winded introduction to say what we're really talking about today is how do people respond to others who have, quote-unquote, left the faith?
And this author is a Christian?
I'm assuming so, yes.
Okay.
Writing for the Gospel Coalition.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Christians, their perspective on Christians who leave the faith.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah. I think one of the first things early in this article is she makes mention that Rhett and Link have magnetic personalities. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when they shared their stories about deconversion and or deconstruction, she makes note that many atheists that they inspired many atheists and touched the hearts of some folks that were experiencing similar deconversion stories, describing the videos as beautiful, candid, and vulnerable. Okay, so I just want to pause there for a second. And she's going to dismantle that idea in a little bit, but I wanted to take a moment and say, I think there's some value in respecting someone's journey and honoring it, even if it's not your own. And there's, so to me, this article's a little owie.
And even if they're in a hard place.
Yes.
Right.
So for instance, I'm gonna tie this to me for a second, and then I want to hear your thoughts. Because of this framework that is being adopted by this article, which is, I think, in truth, true for most of Christian experiences, I didn't feel that I could have openly said, I'm struggling with my faith. I don't understand how things are working. I had fears of people leaving me, telling me negative things because I shared with them that I struggled with some of this stuff. And so there was no one to actually hear this. I couldn't debrief these feelings, aside from you,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't debrief these feelings in my trusted, faithful community by saying, I have doubts. And it's not even like I have doubts, but I mean like, stuff isn't working. Like, I don't understand how this is working. I'm really, really questioning these things. And part of it is I know the counter arguments, so I know what they were going to say back to me. You know, someone once told me, well, Rob, you just don't know the power of the Bible. And that's not a helpful phrase. So, did you experience anything like that in this process? Or?
Well, no.
Were you able?
Because I had the shunning aspect. I didn't have
yeah.
the interaction. I mean, I don't know what you're asking, what I experienced. Did I experience criticism? I have no idea. Nobody said it to me.
Hmm. Did you feel that you could have openly talked about your criticisms of what was going on? Or did you just not have those criticisms?
That I could have spoken what I thought was going wrong, or that people could have come to me?
Correct. And, well,
I mean, I would have been open to people talking to me about how they, you know, what they saw. And especially people who, you know, we had in our community, we had people that we were spending 3-4 nights a week with.
Mm-hmm.
And those people could have come to me and said, here's what I'm seeing. But I would have preferred it if that did happen, where they didn't come like an intervention, but came and said, hey, what's going on, and heard my perspective as well.
Mm.
I think I would have felt less alone.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling you didn't maybe have some of the thoughts that I had up until the event. And I tend to be an internal processor, so I don't vocalize a lot of those thoughts.
Which means I have no idea what you're thinking. Contrary to popular belief, I do not read your mind.
Yeah, you do.
I know you well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so...
But I will say, on this subject, when people are hurting, it takes a different kind of perspective to be in that hurting space with people. And when we met, I was volunteering at the suicide support chat room, remember?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah,
that's
yeah,
back
yeah,
when
yeah.
chat rooms were
yeah,
a thing.
I remember, yep.
It takes a certain mindset to be able to be with people in their darkness and to say, it's okay, you know, I've especially, and me being... more melancholy, it's a comfortable place for me. It's a lot of people, it's not comfortable.
Right.
So I don't fault anyone who doesn't step into that space, or I don't know what this author's perspective is, but
we'll get to it because
in this context, I'm assuming that she does not care for the dark spaces of doubt.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that.
Or unbelief or fear or grief or sadness, because those are a part of life, period, whether it's in a Christian context or not.
Sure, sure.
So you can't separate the goodness from the badness to me.
Right, yeah, got it. Yeah, I really just wanted to make a note that if someone has struggling and they're being authentic with where they're at, I would hope that Christians and non-Christians alike, anyone could listen to their story and be kind and respectful to what they're experiencing.
That is not what I've experienced.
Yeah.
And I have very much experienced in multiple Christian circles, multiple churches, where when things get rough, they'll say like, hey, write it on the prayer request or whatever. But people are uncomfortable in that space. And it doesn't matter, even outside of Christian circles, people are uncomfortable in that space, which is kind of my point, that people don't like to hear the hard things.
Right.
They don't want to be faced, because it's a reflection of their own concerns and fears.
Right.
That they say, if I don't think about it, it's not there.
Right. Right. They've spent so much time pushing it down, and here you are trying to dig it out of
Dredge it up.
Yeah.
They're like, no, don't do that.
Okay. All right. So there's this next section where the author titles, you know, Deconstructing Deconstruction. And she says, reasonable answers exist for each notion the duo passed along that, in their opinion, defeats the truth of Christianity. And to me, that's the line in the sand, right? So this author is saying, here's the line, you know, you're a Christian or you're not. And when Rhett and Link, in this case, shared with them their experiences and their thoughts about the Bible and the church and their expressions, and then they came to a different way of thinking
than Orthodox Christianity.
Than Orthodox Evangelical Christianity. Okay. Then this author is now saying, you're on the other side. You're not one of us anymore. There is truth to that. I don't blame that, because by definition, and this is where I think the conversation gets interesting and hurtful. By definition, belonging to a thing that has a separate set of attributes that makes it that thing is exclusionary.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why there's mixed messaging and troubles when Christianity claims to be all-inclusive. It's for everyone. but it's not for everyone. There's actually a conversion process that says you've got to come as you are, but not stay as you are, lest you go back out. You know, you come as you are.
Right.
We're going to assess the situation, guide you through the necessary changes, and if you make them okay, we'll open the door and you can come in. You can be part of us.
These concepts are so foreign to me. I had, like, first of all, her saying that they have points that make Christianity untrue. Like, if it's true, how can they make it untrue? That's my first question. My second thing is I have never been under the understanding that the people in the church are part of the conversion process. And I think that's because I didn't grow up in the Protestant church. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But to me, it's always been something that you that's between you and God. It's not something that people are a part of. Like, right. it's a transformation. As much as a butterfly can resist becoming a butterfly from a caterpillar, is as much as, you know, it's not something that the community is a part of.
Right.
So this is a different concept for me. This is not something, this is not the same, I'm not starting from the same point on this conversation.
You saw this, let me ask, did you see this in your experiences working at Evangelical Church? Like, did you see the included and the excluded and who can participate and who can't participate?
Yes, you know? But I'd never understood it.
Yeah.
Like, I intellectually understood it, but I didn't believe the same. I don't have the same foundation of belief, so I didn't ascribe to that, if you will. Mm-hmm. The included and excluded, to me, if it's come as you are, your transformation process, like, may be different than mine. It may happen in a night. It may happen in 50 years. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, I would never be so presumptuous as to say that you had a timeline that I could control or that I was part of. And I know that we contribute to each other's lives, but that sounds so crazy to me. That sounds literally crazy to me. Like a sickness. Like, how can I control your progress?
Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds stressful, honestly. It's giving me anxiety thinking about it.
Like, it gives a lot of people anxiety, for sure.
Like, how much pressure is that? Do people actually live thinking that they have a responsibility for other people's spiritual progress?
Yeah, and that's what we're talking about.
I mean,
that's this conversation.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking, but they actually feel personally responsible?
Yes.
Yeah. I wouldn't sleep at night.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
So years before the megachurch, I was a local minister at a smaller holiness-centered denominational evangelical church. I won't say the name, but it was a holiness-centered. Mm-hmm. And the holiness movement was really keen on this idea of personal sanctification.
Okay.
And quite frankly, the goal was to never sin. And consequently, my experience in that place began to break down when I saw what I thought and were told were these extremely holy people that were elders and such. And then I started to see, oh, they do sin. They do sin. And I had experiences of seeing that.
Well, how do they not share it?
Well, then there's forgiveness. And, you know what I'm saying? So it's like,
oh,
this.
Oh, okay. It's back to the sacrifices.
Right. It's that.
You sin, you sacrifice. You're
right.
Forgiven. It's, you sin, you sacrifice.
Right.
You're forgiven.
Right. Okay, right. Got it. That law, grace law sandwich.
The Old Testament, yeah, I gotcha.
You need to behave so that you can be good. Oh, but here's some grace in the middle of it. But you got to stay in the good grace because you still can't sin anymore. And so it's this nasty sandwich that people like to get.
It's the Old Testament. I mean, I read the Old Testament. It's how many goats do I have to give
up? You're right. Sure. So it, by very definition, it is that exclusionary process of saying you're either like this or you're not like this. There's no in between. Okay. Now, in this article, she begins to come back to this. So she's already. I'm gonna actually add words and meaning to what she said. So okay. This is me adding
conjecture,
to her. This
right?
is conjecture. I can hear that there's a little bit of fear here because you have some celebrity and charismatic people that have influence over others that might be less resolute in their own belief. They're really dangling off of the belief of someone else, right? And it's through that celebrity that the young folks are like, oh yeah, I'm a Christian too, because Rhett and Link are a Christian and they're cool and I want to be cool. And that sounds trite, but that's true for all of us that want to belong to a certain group. Like, that is, I think, a core of human nature.
Okay.
When we go to a heavy metal show, we put on black t-shirts.
The uniform, yeah.
You got to put on the uniform. Jeans.
Black boots.
Black boots and a black t-shirt.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you won't be part of the... You won't be part
Sometimes
of,
I don't wear black. Because I don't really care.
But you do stick out like a sore thumb when you show up and you've got a white t-shirt on. Or like my brother, who went to a Danzig show in white jeans and a neon tank top.
That's what I would do. Because I think it's hilarious.
And, you know, he definitely stuck out.
He looked like he was at the wrong show.
Yeah, he looked like he was at the wrong show. But anyway, so that is... I just still think that's... normal behavior. And part of that is my point. People are attracted to groups of people and want to align themselves with that group of people that they're attracted to. That's normal tribalism. That's
sure.
That's a sense of belonging. And I just don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing on its own. Okay. So.
Wait, it does remind me there's in the news right now, there's a big controversy about Taylor Swift's new album having some darker notes to it.
Right.
And parents in an uproar because their kids are listening to it. And I read something, and I unfortunately don't know where I read it, but it really resonated with me, that Taylor Swift is not responsible for the spiritual well-being or emotional well-being or happiness of your children. She's just talking about her experiences,
right?
And that we all experience
right.
these hard places,
right?
And discussing them should not be a problem. It's, and like you said earlier, it's a place where people can connect and not feel alone in those spaces, and that's important.
Yeah, and I'll go so far as to say I'm not aware. You know, I'm not super hip on Taylor Swift's discography. Not that I'm not opposed to it, I just don't know. I'm ignorant about it, and. In my opinion, true art is someone that's outpouring some creative version of themselves that expresses something. And then it's a bonus when people can relate. Like that's actually a therapeutic thing. In fact, I have a playlist that I've curated about like spiritual deconstruction to me. Songs that make me think about these topics or put me in the right headspace, and it's very valuable to me. So I'm glad that, A, Taylor Swift exists in the world and gives words and voices and emotions and music to loads of people so that they don't feel alone and might feel some level of catharsis. And I'm sad that parents would...
Criticize
that they have an outlet.
Yeah.
You know, that honesty.
Yeah. I mean, I understand... Actually, I can't even say that. I don't understand parents' concern with music. I don't think that music is as influential as actually the parents are. And, you know, when I was talking to our kids about this topic before we started this podcast, one of my oldest daughters said, parents have the greatest influence. Like, you guys are the... creators of this environment, you know, and all kinds of music can exist, but what the parents say about those topics is more important. You know, maybe they're not having those conversations with their kids because it's one of those spaces where they just would rather not look at. They'd rather not go there.
Right.
But that's on the parents. That's not on the artist or in this case, Rhett and Link.
Right. And I think the worst point in the article, she says... This brings us to the salient question. How can two guys who make a living on YouTube go from making possum corn dogs one day to throwing 2,000 years of of Christian history under the bus, and why were so many people rattled and even persuaded by them? And the thing that gets me about that sentiment is she's trying to devalue them and what they've done, whether you like it or not. They've connected to people. They've had a creative outlet, and people enjoy it. And so there's a sense of joy. Imagine if you had the power to bring joy to people, and then being told the way you do that is stupid, and how is it that you have any influence? And then at the same time, being able to say, you have that influence, so much so that you're attacking this other thing that I think is valuable and needs to be, you know, gatekeeped, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think this conversation is really a precursor to our cult conversation, because celebrity is a part of that. And what we're doing here is, I think, starting the conversation by saying, what is it that a charismatic people, how do they have effects on us? Mm-hmm. And how do we respond, and what does that mean in these contexts? Okay.
Well, I think for me personally, and probably you can verify this, I know a lot of people get like starstruck, and they're really, you know, working for a mega church with a semi-celebrity pastor.
Right.
They would get really excited, like, oh my gosh, I got to speak to him today. This is what he said to me, and just hang on every word.
Right.
I have a lot of respect for people, but I don't have the same like starstruck experience. I don't think I've ever had that. I can't think of anyone that I would be starstruck around, living or dead.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if someone asked me who I'd want to meet, maybe Abraham Lincoln. I have some questions, but like, I wouldn't be starstruck. I wouldn't be dumbfounded. I don't fangirl.
Even
when I meet band members in the airport in Seattle, I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't have that same experience.
Shout out to Druid Lord.
Yeah. What's up? But I don't have that same experience.
Yeah.
I just see people as people, and I think that all people have value. So there's not this like, oh my gosh, this is an elevated person to me. Like, I'm excited to meet people who I don't know their name or their, I've never heard of them.
Right. If you are a part of a mega church, mm-hmm. of a certain size, and ours included, you would every weekend you'd get phone calls asking who's preaching.
Oh yeah, and the numbers would go up based on who was there.
And if the well-liked celebrity pastor was preaching, attendance would be high. And if there was a guest speaker, not so high, you know, or an unknown,
well,
not so high.
Well, depends on the guest speaker.
Well, of course. Again, depending on the celebrity, right?
If they're on the radio and they're super popular, maybe.
Sure.
They have a great voice.
Sure. So, I'm skipping around this article a little bit, and it gets to a place where the author brings up apostasy. Apostasy is real. That's a section that she goes into. And then the last heading is this section called Apostles of Unbelief. And that phrase really stuck out to me, and I think it's provocative. It's a provocative phrase. And here's my question. We know that the Bible talks about apostasy, those that leave their faith, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there's two offshoots, kind of, to this. One is, oh, they weren't really Christians to begin with, and therefore the two decades of ministry that they may or may not have had gets annulled. It's garbage. Throw it in the trash. Or they are... they've committed apostasy, and now they're apostles of unbelief. You've got a tribe, and you're moving from one tribe to the next, and you want people from that one tribe to come with you to the new tribe.
I mean, is that what they're doing?
No, and they're not. They're honestly not. But maybe we are, you and I specifically. Maybe we're sitting here in these chairs, and we're talking about leaving institutional religion, evangelical Christianity, and the confines of systematic theology, I am. I won't put words in your mouth.
Okay.
I am.
Okay.
I've done those things. And I have a podcast now, and we're spreading it out on the internet, and we're causing disbelief among those that might listen.
We're causing disbelief.
That's a great question.
So my perspective on this is you cannot lead somebody where they're not willing to go.
Mm.
And it's funny because I wonder if these same people also have a strong belief in, choice and agency in your faith. You have a choice. I don't know. I don't, again, feel personally responsible for other people's journeys. And I think that's probably coming from my background, from my childhood and what I experienced there, that's probably a boundary that I'm not willing to carry.
Mm.
Now I do have that some for my children, which I think is normal as a mom.
Sure, sure.
Like, because they're my responsibility, but outside of that, I don't...
Their salvation? Or just, you mean in general,
no, I just mean their well-being is my responsibility. Yeah. Honestly, even for my children, I don't consider their salvation my responsibility.
Mm.
And I don't know how people... I don't know how people take it if they...
Do you know who Kirk Cameron is?
Wait, was he an actor?
Yes.
Okay, well, I don't know what show he was in, but...
Family Ties?
Okay, yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
And he's an evangelical Christian now?
I didn't know that, but...
What, I mean, he has been...
Does he do the Left Behind series?
That's a good question. Maybe.
I'm going to fact check. Okay, tell me about him.
Okay. Well, the only reason I bring him up is, I don't know if you've seen any videos of him, but some of the videos I've seen of him, he seems to be one of the saddest people alive. And I think it's because he feels the weight of the unbelief in the world on his shoulders. And if you ever watch interviews with him, or maybe just a handful of that I've seen from him.
He's Left Behind the movie. He's in that.
He's in that movie? Yeah. I remember him from a kid as a sitcom from...
Sure.
I think it's Family Ties. I could be wrong, though.
Anyways.
Doesn't matter.
Because he carries the weight of that?
He carries the weight of people's... Like, the world's... So he feels like he's got to go to the ends of the earth and preach the good news, the Great Commission, and he's sad... Again, it's my impression of it. He's sad that it just hasn't been done yet, and he just, I feel, comes across as miserable.
Well, to someone who has that perspective, I would ask, like, how do you reconcile the notion that, like, sadness and hunger, like, people who are starving, like, that will always be here. Like, we'll always have, things that are not right with our society. We'll always have people that are choosing to hurt other people. Mm. We'll always have people that are underprivileged, that are hungry, that are, like, how do they cope with that? Is that part of the weight that they carry? Because that seems enormous.
It seems so enormous. Well, it was. I mean, in that Holiness Church, when I was a local minister before this mega church, I went to my friend and I, we went and we got loudspeakers and we went to the ghettos in Cincinnati and we knocked on every door when they're doing drugs out in the streets. And we said, come to church. We're going to have a church service in the park right here and come join us. And we'd gather 15, 20 people and we'd preach and sing terribly. I mean, we were the worst singers ever. And we would sing our little hearts out. And that was all driven because we thought we were making a difference from an eternal perspective. Now, here's the thing.
Okay.
I want to conclude that thought real fast.
Okay.
I think simultaneously we were and we were not.
Exactly.
So while we had... a part to play in an experience for their particular life for a particular moment, we were an agent of that kind of change. Mm-hmm. And that was done in good faith. At the same time, it was also not on us to do that or to succeed in that. It is my belief that if there is a thing for salvation, that it is in the hands of the Savior to complete those things in the way that he or she needs them to happen.
That he or she, like the person who needs saving?
No. The he Savior. Or she as in, like, the God.
Oh, okay.
I don't like appropriating masculinity to God anymore, so
that's fine. I appreciate that. Okay, I just wanted to specify.
Yes.
Because a lot of people think that they're the ones who save other people. That's why I was saying that.
Yeah. That's a good point to clarify. And all I'm saying is like, in the cosmic soup of our existence, we are going to go where we're going with, and I'm of two minds, and I admit I'm of two minds, without intention and or with total intention. Meaning, I either have no control in what happens to me, or I have total control or some marriage thereof. And I don't know that we know. I just don't know that I know enough. I'm not willing to say that burden falls on anyone.
Yeah, I think where my boundaries lie in this particular subject is that I have limited control over my own actions, meaning there are some things that I can't control. If I'm driving in a car and another car hits me, mm-hmm. you know. But I have limited control over my own actions and even less control over other people's. So control is an interesting word. I would say there's places of influence. And in this case of Rhett and Link, I think that they do have influence. But again, you can't influence somebody who's not willing to be influenced by that. So if they're sharing their unbelief and somebody is strong in their belief, I think that it will only make them stronger in their belief.
Yeah, sure.
If they're speaking about their unbelief and they're speaking to someone who has unbelief, it may influence their unbelief, mm-hmm. but it's not going to influence what's not already there. Mm. Like, there has to be the beginnings of it already there. Mm-hmm.
How did those beginnings get there?
How did those begin? So, I mix very easily theology and science. They go together to me. Yeah. There's no separation, and I know there's huge schools of thought in either side. To me, they live together, and they work together, and the places that I don't know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. That question is the same to me as where does matter come from?
Well, let me say it differently, right? So we know the parable of the sower or the seeds, you know, the seed that gets planted. And so anyway, I'm alluding back to that. You've got this seed of faith that gets planted. Is there a seed of doubt that can be planted? Or is that too convoluted and not really?
Well, so it depends on the person.
And then I guess how do those get there?
How do they get there?
Yeah, who plants the seed of faith? Who plants the seed of doubt? Just individual people?
So are we talking theoretically or practically, pragmatically?
Whichever way you want to.
Okay, so pragmatically, I think in an individual's life, there are instances in which, I'll give you a hypothetical situation. Say you have a family with two children, right? And the family is, they're alcoholics. The parents are alcoholics. You have one child who grows up and becomes an alcoholic. And the other child, who's very close in age, grows up and doesn't drink anymore.
Ever. Right.
They avoid alcohol. Mm-hmm. They have the same background. The same seeds were planted, and yet one grew in one way and one grew in the other way. So you're asking, why does it go one way or the other? I think that all the possible seeds are available at all times.
I like that.
And so the way that it grows has to do with the person and their perspective, their worldview, their relationship with their eternity, I'll say creator, whatever, if they have faith or no faith. And I would say even people who don't believe in a God have principles.
Sure.
I have atheist friends and they have principles and they have things they feel very strongly about.
Right. Right.
They have a moral compass, the ones that I've met. And so I think all of those kind of combine in what you call cosmic soup. So the beginning and the end is not black and white. And I don't ascribe to it being black and white. I don't say, oh, you heard this podcast, now you're not a Christian.
Right.
Oh, you're not practicing Christianity, you're not a Christian anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's black and white, and I don't ascribe to that at all. I think life is much more complex.
You know, I align with you now. Mm-hmm. I there was a point in time when I did not align with that way of thinking.
I know. We would have lots of follow-up conversations after every event.
But I have come full circle to, I think, appreciate the gray in this space, the non-binary of this is true and this is false, but really there's something in between. Like there's reality exists in a spectrum in most ways. So I'm kind of that way minded now. However, I do want to go on record and say something specific. One, that this article points out, and two, that I agree with.
Okay.
And that is, I think definitions do matter, which is why I don't call myself a Christian anymore. Because I know that the consensus among those that are self-professing Christians have definitions and an orthodox belief. They have a, you know, they can draw lines to where and how they've got to those definitions. And because I don't necessarily ascribe to that anymore, I don't use that word. And I appreciate the meaning of that word as they do. And I know I have a friend who is not an Orthodox Christian, but still views himself as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very unorthodox. And most evangelical Christians would not label him a Christian. He doesn't care that he's using that word in a way that is distressful to some folks. Like, that's just his personality, and the word works for him. I want to go on the record and say that, like, when I would go to Catholic Mass with you, mm-hmm. I never partook of the Eucharist because I didn't go through catechism. And for me, this was a sign of respect. I know that they want those that have been through catechism to participate in taking of the Eucharist and to take the body. And so when I would go to a Catholic Mass, my way of respecting their beliefs is by not, even though I at the time was a Christian and, you know, had that, I didn't do that because I wasn't in that group.
Sure.
So those definitions and those categories matter to me. Or I should say they have meaning to me.
Yeah, I don't necessarily see it that way, but I'm not a big categories person.
Right.
But because I would say you would be hard-pressed to get Christians to even agree on what their...
Totally agree.
On what their
right.
What their definitions
right.
are. Like, within the Christian groups, even within a single church.
That's correct.
You'd be hard-pressed to get them all to agree
right.
to it.
And that
to me, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because even in our megachurch experience, because there are so many people not only attending, there are so many people in leadership. Even those that were in leadership had varying views of certain things, you know, the partaking of the sacraments being one of them, or, you know, women in leadership or not is another one, or, you know,
baptism,
baptism dunked or sprinkled or, you know, all that
stuff. I know,
stuff.
I tell my kids, well, you've been sprinkled, dedicated, and baptized, so you're pretty covered.
You're good.
Whatever you decide, you're good.
Yeah, we have done all of the rituals to ensure your salvation.
Not all, but yeah. I'm sure there's some.
We'll sign them up for the rest. But anyway, so I want to go on record and say that I do want to honor people that have that name, that call themselves Christians, and say that their category is important to them. If it's important to them, it's important to me, and I don't want to devalue it anyway. But this topic of celebrities, charismatic leaders, And influence over groups of people is going to come back. We're going to come back to that in other episodes because it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's part of human nature. And it has multiple expressions as it relates to faithful groups and non-faithful groups, for that matter.
I do think that if you carry a position of leadership, that your influence is greater than someone who doesn't have that position of leadership.
Right.
Like when you're, when the owner of a company asked you to do something, it has more weight than when the secretary of the mailroom asked you to do something, right? There's a different weight there.
Sure.
The owner of the company is personally asking you.
Right.
There's an emphasis. But ultimately, I do believe in personal agency and that people have the opportunity to ask questions that are counter to their current belief system, and that it could go either way. It could strengthen their current belief system, or it could go the other way, and that asking the questions itself is not wrong.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's where I'm at too, that's all I want to do is ask questions now. I don't want any answers. I just want to ask questions and think about things.
I mean, I want answers, but there are none to some questions.
Mm, do I want answers? Boy, that's a.
I want to look for answers. I enjoy the seeking aspect.
I don't think I want answers.
It's okay. You don't have to.
But I think I know why I don't want answers. Is because I don't want definitives.
You don't
want
to be boxed in.
No, that's not. I mean, that.
You don't
want
to be jammed up.
I don't want to be jammed up. No, it's I like the infinite, and I don't like the finite.
Mm.
The infinite is cool, imaginative, mysterious, wonderful. The moment that, here's the answer, then it becomes trite, or now it's just book knowledge. Now it's literally just, mystery's gone.
Sure.
So there's a part of me that doesn't want these answers, I want to... Or I want to find the questions that you kind of honed in on. Maybe there are answers, but I'm really trying to find the questions that don't have answers because those are the ones I like to,
ponder
and participate in. And so anyway, this is really a precursor to some other deeper topics regarding influence and celebrity conversations. So I'm actually looking forward to those. So this is a good...
Shout out to Rhett and Link and Taylor Swift, who's living their truth.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually do appreciate...
Authenticity is a big deal.
And again, even if you don't know anything about Rhett and Link, them telling about their story is very compelling. They're very compelling folks. And listening to them talk about it, you can hear the pain and the anguish and the release. And, you can hear all of that, and it's very human, and you can connect to it really well. And even if you know Rhett and Link, and you're saddened that they don't believe anymore, I don't think they want you to be sad on their behalf, I think that they have found out a more authentic self where they're at. And like I've said before, who knows? In 10 years, I may be, in an evangelical church preaching again. Who knows? I don't think so, but... you never know. That's not outside. There's a non-zero chance for that. And so for me, it's kind of important to recognize that I'm not aware of the future. I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm open. I'm open.
That's good. That's a good place to be.
You're right. Right. Do you have any other concluding thoughts on this before we hit the stop button?
No, I don't think so.
Are you looking forward to our future episodes?
I am. Yeah, I enjoy recording these conversations. We have the conversations all the time.
Are you concerned about some of the topics that we have coming up next?
No, I'm excited about them.
Oh, really?
I have. There's like this topic you have a lot to say, but there's some that I have a lot to say on. So.
I can't wait. All right. With that being said, thank you for joining, and we'll catch you next time.
Take care.
Bye-bye.